from KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Education Today. Good afternoon and welcome to Education Today. I'm your host, Kitty Kelly Epstein. Just a few education events we should be aware of before we talk with our guest today. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos has resigned her position as a result of the right-wing assault on the Capitol on Wednesday. For many progressives, she was the worst of education secretaries, with her intense support for privatization and her intense opposition to civil rights protections for students. She will be replaced by Miguel Cardona, who seems to be somewhat of a centrist on education issues. I went and read his dissertation, and I'm happy that he is at least familiar with progressive education concepts like critical race theory and communicative approaches to second language instruction. However, I am concerned because at the moment, the federal government is requiring school districts to do standardized testing for all students, which is both practically and pedagogically impossible. U.S. students currently take 112 standardized tests in the years from kindergarten to 12th grade. Students in other developed countries take three. Mr. Cardona needs to hear from lots of people that testing children who have not had equal access to school this year is even worse than testing them in other years. This can't happen. Teachers need to oppose this, and so does the general public. Governor Newsom has proposed a new measure that would offer incentives for California school districts to reopen schools for in-person instruction by February 15th. It is opposed by the leaders of the biggest California school districts and many other people, including me. 4,000 Americans died of COVID yesterday. The idea that it's okay to stick 700 or 800 people together inside a school building when we call 30 people together inside a house a super spreader event is crazy. And a lot of parents seem to agree with me. Our guest today is a Bay Area activist who has done something wonderful for children and for grownups. Jack Lucero Fleck is a leader of the Georgia John George Democratic Club and an activist in the environmental movement. And he has also created a methodology for teaching dialectics in a simple way. Why is this important? First of all, the left-wing movements that created successful revolutions in a dozen countries use this methodology to strategize. Chinese revolutionaries beat both the Japanese government and the reactionary Chinese government of Chiang Kai-shek during World War II. This was an enormous victory for the poor people of the world. The modern American left seems to have separated itself from these successful revolutions because they didn't do everything perfectly. And we end up with no theory of change at all. This lack of a theory of change affects both our lack of political strategy and our lack of educational finesse. I know dozens of students taking courses and programs in educational change, and when I ask them how change occurs, they can't answer. So Jack Fleck will be talking with us about how he came to focus on dialectics and the details of his work. Jack, welcome to Education Today.
Thanks, Kitty. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you've created a whole wonderful set of ideas for teaching dialectics to grown-ups and kids, which I have actually used myself. I wonder, before we get into the details of that, if you could just tell us in brief what dialectics is. We might have forgotten in the U.S. since we don't talk about it anymore.
Okay, well, I think of it as a way to explain change. I think we all understand that change is a constant. Everything changes, but how it changes is the realm of dialectics. And in some ways, it's a very much a reflection of Newton's laws of change, although he just refers to objects like billiard balls and bullets. But two of his laws are very dialectical. One is, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And another one is, there is no movement without a force. And these are two laws of dialectics, that this is what happens. Nothing changes. Frederick Douglass has a famous quote, if there's no struggle, there's no progress. This is a very fundamental concept that we have to push to overcome the forces that are opposing us. But dialectics is much broader than just objects. It has to do with society and nature and thought. Everything is a process, every process has a dialectical character. So we're always trying to look at the opposing forces and what we need to do to build the forces that can overcome them and make changes. And there's one other point about dialectics that's very important, which is that change happens bit by bit, then all at once. There's a quantitative change where the pressure builds up. Now, this happens in nature. If you have a huge amount of snow on a mountain, it can build up to the point when all at once the forces that are ready to make that into an avalanche happen, and then it collapses. But that happens in our human bodies. If a baby is growing inside the womb, it grows and grows until it finally matures, and then one day it's born. And similarly, we make decisions in using that same bit-by-bit process. Our hair grows longer and longer until one day, hey, you know, I really need a haircut today. And it happens every night. We sleep, our body gradually gets rested, and then all at once, bit by bit, and all at once, we wake up. And just one other example, which I have to laugh at, is that today Betsy DeVos said that she had reached an inflection point when Trump's antics of stirring up all those people. And I said, well, welcome, Betsy, to the world of dialectics. Hey, you just came to a turning point where you finally got fed up. So anyway, I thought that was great that you mentioned that on the beginning.
That's a very beautiful example. Very beautiful example. So why do you think it's important for people to learn about it?
Well, we all need to make changes in our life. And, you know, just feeling confident that we can do that is, you know, a big asset in our lifetime. So some changes are pretty simple. Like, you have to get out of bed every morning. You have to overcome the forces that are keeping you in bed. And to some extent, that's physical. You have to have the strength to do it. But it's also mental. You have to say, well, I really want to get up today. You know, I want to get out there and I want to go to school. I want to go to work. I got to do what I have to do. So those are all real forces that are holding us back and making us want to make those changes. And so, if, of course, that's a simple example, and there's lots of simple examples. I'm doing dishes all the time. I have to change those dishes from being dirty to being washed. That's a dialectical change, but it's a bigger change. We go to school, say, for years and years, bit by bit. Every year we're studying and trying to advance until finally, all at once, we graduate. That's what we achieve. So all of our life is really controlled by these dialectical processes, and it works in our political life as well, but I don't tend to stress that in the website that I worked on, Dialectics for Kids, because I think all these daily examples give us a better feel for what dialectics is really all about.
So I agree with you, and I've actually used your Dialectics for Kids a lot, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a few minutes, but so I think the common everyday examples are the most effective way to help people to understand it. But I do wonder also why it's important for political change in the world, because I think that's something you think also, that we should, that we have practical uses for it and we also have political uses for it. So has it been important for political change in the world before?
Yeah, I think you introduced it. The people who developed dialectics and dialectical materialism made incredible changes. They overthrew the system of private property in half of the countries in the world. Now, it didn't work out too well economically, and you know, we can argue about why that was. You know, I think that it's pretty clear to me that having a top-down command socialist economy was not really a workable situation. But to me, the tools that they used, the dialectics, as you mentioned, the way the Chinese very correctly pointed out that the Chinese communists won that war in a lot of ways, because they pointed out that the main enemy was the Japanese during World War II. And the nationalist Chinese lost a lot of their credibility because they didn't really form the united front that the communists wanted. And the people in China said, hey, we've got to defeat the Japanese. Let's not fight among ourselves. Let's get this over with. Anyway, so that's one example. But, you know, it comes up all the time. I work with groups that do power mapping. So if you want to make a change, you have to see who are the forces on your side, who are the forces opposing you, and look at how you can create a balance of forces that tips the scale in your favor. So even though people don't use the term dialectics, I think that is a very dialectical process, to do a power map and try to figure out what it's going to take to actually achieve the change that you want.
So I want to explore that a little bit more, but before, so the Chinese are a great example, and Mao talked about dialectics, and one of my students so blessedly allowed me to talk to her mother, who lived through the Chinese Revolution and was educated in China, and they used the dialectical principles to teach kids in school. So one of the principles they used was to teach very little children, you know, in second or third grade, that they had both weaknesses and strengths, and they could use their strengths to overcome their weaknesses. In a way, it's the kind of thing we tell children all the time, except we don't put it in quite that way and teach them that that's something they can analyze and use for themselves. So she thought it was a very important part of her education to learn that she had the capacity to analyze her own strengths and weaknesses. So the Chinese clearly used it a lot, but there are a lot of other countries that used it also. Can you say more about that?
Well, actually, you know, when I became politicized, it was Vietnam. You know, we were chanting in the streets, "Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh, NLF is going to win." So we admired the work that Ho Chi Minh had done. And then I've been to Cuba several times and admired the work of the Cuban Revolution. And they've all used these ideas of dialectics to try to overcome the obstacles they face. Now, again, I say the model that they may have started out with a top-down kind of command economy, has been modified quite a bit. But the theory of change, how you have to overcome the opposing forces using a dialectical method, I think is still very sound. And I think that's where I started with this whole project, was there was a quote from Engels where he said that any school child, you know, people might start out with the idea that dialectics is really complicated and mystical, but once they understand it, any school child can understand it. It's not really difficult at all. And in fact, they might say, well, this is so obvious that they dismiss it as being irrelevant. But then he adds, but to have come up with a theory that explains nature and society and thought all in one theory is actually a very profound event.
So, so Engels wrote a lot about this. The Marx and Engels were into dialectics. The Russian Revolution used it. The Cubans, the Vietnamese, as you have said. So I worry myself because on the left we seem to ignore the victories of our predecessors. And they might not have been perfect, but wow, they did really achieve a lot. And there's a whole lot of people in the world that'd be going hungry now. If they hadn't and not learning to read at all and so on, if they hadn't used dialectics to make some change, so I'm kind of feeling like we should be embracing and talking more about the revolutionary people who went before us and how much they did change the world, and along with it, maybe some of the strategies that they used and the thinking they used. So my question to you, I guess, is, why doesn't anybody, and I think this, there's little writing about dialectics, I mean modern writing, from what I've been able to dig up, and not much conversation about dialectics. So I wonder why that is. Why do you feel that people on the left in the U.S., and I think probably perhaps in Europe also, don't talk about dialectics anymore?
Well, first of all, I would say the main reason that it's not taught in the schools is that in any class society, the people that are in power do not really embrace change. They don't really want to teach everybody, hey, you can go on strike and, you know, overthrow the system or anything like that. That's been true since the beginning of class society. So, you know, that's number one. And in terms of why don't people on the left use it, of course, I think it was a lot discredited in the Russians under Stalin would say, well, our five-year plan is the embodiment of dialectical materialism, which, you know, was kind of nonsense, because dialectical materialism is a very broad conceptual thing. It's not like a specific how many tons of steel are you going to make this year, you know. So people kind of associated it with a sort of very rigid, dogmatic way of thinking. And I think, unfortunately, that sort of threw everything off. So that's why I really appreciate that you've brought it into your classrooms. I actually had a really good experience. I brought it to a fourth grade class in Berkeley, and the kids were all very receptive. I play a lot of games, like we take a balloon with a tire pump and pump it up, and it gets bigger and bigger, changes bit by bit, then pop, it all pops at once. Of course, that's quite a spectacle for the kids to see.
Right. And that will be their favorite lesson, no matter whether it's about dialectics or not. You popping the balloon right. is going to make it memorable, right?
It's very memorable. Even to me, it's very memorable. So, yeah, I think that getting, and you know, the other thing, I remember asking the kids, well, what kind of changes do you want to make? And, you know, one of the kids I thought came up with a brilliant idea. She said, well, you know, I need to save money, and then bit by bit, I'll eventually save enough that I can buy this thing that I want. And I was saying, oh, that's a really good idea. I hadn't thought of that, you know? And so the kids come up with this on their own because they want to make changes. And I think that I'm happy that China taught it in the history back then. I don't think they do it today, but unfortunately that is. But I think that if the kids can get it, and if we have a chance as teachers and students or whoever, whatever role we have with our young people to get them to understand these simple concepts, I think it would be good.
So just on the legitimacy of dialectics, to my knowledge, nobody's posed a different theory of change that could compete with dialectics as a way of understanding how the world works. Is that true, or... is there a competing theory of change? I understand one competing theory is don't talk about it at all. Just tell people you're going to change things. But is there actually another theory that says this is the way it really happens? It's not dialectics.
Well, I think the way I look at it is dialectical materialism, that there is an alternative to materialism, which is idealism, which is, well, there's supernatural forces, and if you just pray, then things are going to change, you know, things like that. So, you know, that's an alternative theory, where everything is just God's will. And, you know, I was raised as a really fundamentalist Christian, and I understand that way of thinking, but I eventually threw that off in terms of a more scientific approach. And so that's what I like, one of the things I liked about dialectics and dialectical materialism. But dialectics itself, there's a mechanical materialism that says, well, change only happens gradually. It doesn't really happen all at once, the way that dialectics talks about it. And I don't know that that's something that, I don't know, you'd have to get into some real philosophically heavy, you know, Sartre and all these kind of people and how they treat these things. But I don't see anything very convincing out there that says this is wrong. And especially once I look at all the examples, you know, from A to Z of everything from avalanches to popcorn popping and earthquakes and pinata breaking and blast off 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. You know, these are all the ABCs of dialectics that I put in the website. So I just can't see how you can refute that. I mean, it's just so much a part of our daily life that these things seem all, and like Engels said, once people understand it, they say, oh, well, that was obvious. I knew that all along.
Can you say a little bit more about one? Well, first, I want to do this a couple of times. Would you say where your material on dialectics is? And then I'd like to ask you a little bit more about what's in it. So people can actually find this, and it doesn't cost money. And if you want to assign it to your students or teachers you work with, you can do that because it's right there on a website. So you want to tell us where it is, Jack?
Yeah, it's dialectics4kids.org or .com, either one will work. And it has a whole section for teachers and exercises and things you could do with your students. So, you know, you're certainly encouraged to try that out.
So there's a section I recommend maybe reading first, which is a section called What the Heck is Dialectics? And it kind of goes through sort of the same discussion we've been having here. And then there are examples for kids of different ages. So could you give a few more examples of the kinds of things that you give for teachers to show kids how dialectics works?
Well, let's see. One of the things is I mentioned the pumping up the balloon. There's all sorts of exercises you could do, like hold your arms out. And after a little while, they get heavier and heavier, and pretty soon you don't want to hold them out anymore. You put them down. Holding your breath, the same thing. You know, it's a little painful, but take a rubber band, stretch it, and eventually it's going to break and it'll snap. Better do that one with some gloves on. But, you know, these are all breaking points or tipping points, turning points, or to quote the great philosopher Betsy DeVos, inflection points. But
right,
these are
right.
things you could do in the class to demonstrate the way change happens bit by bit, then all at once. Now, there's another aspect of things that you can demonstrate. It's a little bit more complicated, but still pretty easy to understand, which is that change moves in spirals, not in circles. So, like, when we're having a conversation, we turn into our opposites. I'm a speaker now, and I become a listener. Then I become a speaker. You know, we go back and forth. But we don't just repeat the same thing. If I just said, oh, I know you are, but what am I? You know, we do have one of those kind of conversations that just goes around in circles. That's not really a conversation. So what you want is to move forward in the same way that if you take a step with your left foot and then with your right foot, now you're back on your right, back on your left foot, but it's you're two steps ahead. So you kind of have a continual motion, and this is called negation of negation. So that's a little trickier concept, but I think, again, it's really pretty straightforward and people can understand it, that we don't want to just go in circles and repeat ourselves. When we go to school, when we come home, and then we go the next day, we don't just do the same lesson the second day, because we've learned something yesterday and we're going to build on that the next day. So that's another whole important point that I think it's important about dialectics.
Could you say there are three main points, and I think they're worth repeating so people can think about, you know, what is the essence of this? They're, as you've been saying, they're both very complicated and very simple. So could you say them all again, the three main principles of dialectics?
These are the three laws of dialectics from Engels. One is that everything is made of opposites, that we wouldn't be able to hold our body, wouldn't stay together if it didn't have tendons and ligaments and muscles and all these things holding it together. An atom wouldn't stay together if it didn't have positive and negative attraction between the electrons and the nucleus. So everything's made of opposites. That's one. Number two is change happens quantitatively and then qualitatively. That's bit by bit, then all at once. And I've just given a whole bunch of examples in this conversation about that. And then number three is this spiral development, negation of negation, that it to actually evolve forward, you can't just come back to the same point. You have to move into you're not the same as you were yesterday. And that's kind of a dialectic, because you are the same person. You're not a different person. I'm still the same person I was yesterday. But parts of me are different, because for one thing, I'm having this conversation with you, and I'm like, oh, gee, this is something I haven't done before, and it's interesting, and I'm really happy that you gave me this opportunity to talk about all these things. So I'll be a little different after this conversation, because it's something new that just happened to me.
Great examples. So you're listening to Education Today on KPFA 94.1. This is Kitty Kelly Epstein, and I'm interviewing Jack Lucero Fleck, who is talking with us about his work on dialectics and maybe the political implications, and also the work that he did to make it available to children and teachers. And actually, maybe the most accessible parts are when the grown-ups read the kids' part, then the grown-ups tend to get it. Because I've read a lot of things about dialectics myself, and Jack's work is the thing that's made it the most clear to me. Jack, can you tell people again where they can find this work if they want to look on the, on the internet?
So the website, yeah, it's on the internet, Dialectics for Kids with a number 4, dialecticsforkids.com or .org. And yeah, it has lots of these examples and just ways to I think the tagline is, it's a change is so simple that even grown-ups can understand it. So, you know, the kids will get it. They'll say, oh, yeah, this is all obvious. And the grown-ups will say, well, wait a minute, how come I'm, you know, whatever age I am, and I've never heard of all this? Well, that's a problem. And like I say, it is not necessarily in the interest of any ruling class to teach this, because they aren't really that interested in having their own rule challenged and changed. But that's the reality, and it would be good for us all to take some of these lessons into account. And just one other example that I think is if you're teaching history, you know, like there's all sorts of dialectics in history. Like, why did Trump lose? You know, well, the forces, and I know a lot of people in California here that got on the phone and called the swing states and did everything we could to help tip the balance in order to defeat him. That's a very dialectical process that we just went through. And it really pays off when you try to organize. As an organizer, you got to make all those sacrifices to make something happen. And I think as an activist all the years that I've been around, I watched it happen in the Vietnam War, the fact that we were able to turn that around, not just us as a few demonstrators in the United States, but the, of course, the Vietnamese people fighting against the United States, but also the allies around the world that supported them, and including people in the U.S. military who refused to fight or actually went over to the other side. So that's another example. And I might want to just say I'm a climate activist, and we have to overthrow the power of the fossil fuel industry. Right now, they are still a little bit more powerful than the climate movement. But you know what? We have gained a lot in the last number of years. And the fossil fuel industry, their stocks are going down. You know, people can see the writing on the wall. There's no future in fossil fuels. We really want to bury them. And we want to, I use the phrase, full court press. Don't let them even throw the ball in. You know, don't let them get it past half court. We want to hem them in every way we can and make sure that we don't use any more fossil fuels so that we can really rein in global warming. And that's a huge obstacle that the whole world has got to unite around right away.
Thank you for that important thing we have to keep in mind. I guess Jack has chosen that the work of saving the planet is the main contradiction at this point, because if we don't have the planet, we can't do any of our other good political work, and that seems like a good use of dialectics right there. I think a number of other people have made the same choice, but they might not have thought about it in terms of dialectics. I'm anxious to have more people think about dialectics politically, and I hope Jack that you'll want to do that too. You've made a big contribution by explaining it. I think we ought to try to get political people to use it. I'm going to work on that.
Incidentally, you used the phrase main contradiction, and that is a dialectical concept. But, you know, again, it can be very simple, because there's a great quote from Dwight Eisenhower saying that he's always found great wisdom in just doing first things first. And, you know, that's it's kind of simple, you know. It's like, put first things first. You know, you got to solve, you know, if your personal health is in trouble, you've got to take care of that, because you're not going to be able to do anything if you don't take care of it. So you got to do first things first. So that's the main contradiction idea. Yeah.
Beautiful. I want to thank you so much for being with us. I've learned so much from you, and so have my students, who are very excited about everything they've learned from dialectics. I also want to thank our board operator, our engineer, Rod Akeel, our producer, Jaron Epstein, and you, our listeners. You can follow us on Twitter at @educate2day and on my personal Facebook page. Thank you again to our listeners and to our guests. Have a good afternoon. Bye-bye.
KPFA is America's original listener-supported radio station. With no corporate sponsors or underwriting, KPFA's journalism is free from oversight. In these perilous times, a truth-seeking news organization like KPFA is essential. We're dedicated to bringing you clear perspectives and trustworthy information that you deserve. We're looking forward to the challenges in 2021. Please support us today at kpfa.org. Thank you. KPFA paid staff is associated with the Communications Workers of America, CWA, Local 9415. You're listening to 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K24 8BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org.